This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell with you here on this Wednesday morning. Now, Australia has finally delivered its climate change plan.
We're getting it done on emissions reduction. That is the Australian way.
That's Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison there, formally committing to a target of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. But what does the Pacific think of this Australian way? That's coming up first. And also coming up on the program, you're going to hear from Willie Poaching, the first Samoan to be appointed head coach of a first grade rugby league club anywhere in the world.
I'd be lying if I didn't say I questioned at times if it would happen, but I knew with perseverance and the will, I suppose, of wanting to get there and stick with it.
That's coming up on Pacific Beat. First, though, there's been a lukewarm response in the Pacific to the Australian government's new so-called plan to reduce carbon emissions. In the lead-up to the Glasgow Climate Summit, Prime Minister Scott Morrison formally committed the country to a target of a net zero emissions by 2050. But he did not reveal any new policies to achieve that target at the announcement in Canberra yesterday and declined to announce a new 2030 emissions reduction target. Some Pacific Islanders, like former Kiribati President Tenote Tong, have welcomed the net zero commitment, but say that it's not enough and that 2050 is too far away. So how will this play out in the Pacific, where climate policy has been a point of tension between Australia and its island neighbours? Well, Maria Simon Chi-Fung is an e-Kiribati woman with the Edmund Rice Centre's Pacific Calling Partnership Program, and she joins me now. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning, Gonamelri, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to share my perspective on the Australian government plan on net zero by 2050.
Yeah, what was your reaction to Mr. Morrison's announcement?
Look, this plan is not good at all and very disappointing to us Pacific Islanders. I echoed what I have said in the media release that Australia can and must do more. You know, we are all interconnected, and what Australia decides to do on climate change will also impact Kiribati and the whole country. And climate change is a threat to everyone, but especially to the low-lying countries like Kiribati. And the Paris Agreement commits nations to limiting global warming to below 2.0 degrees Celsius, even to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And sadly, we are far from the commitment, and Australia is not doing good at all. And I believe that if we fail at this COP, we will face catastrophic climate impact.
Yeah, Australia's government has declined to commit to a more ambitious 2030 emissions target, obviously staying hovering around that 2050-year line for the net zero commitment. What do you think Pacific Island governments and people are going to think about the fact that it's not more ambitious?
Look, many countries are actually taking action and are stepping up their efforts on climate change, while Australia is lacking way behind. People in Australia and around the globe are seeing the impacts of climate change, such as bushfires, you know, the heat in Canada and the floods in Europe and China. These are happening recently, and so people are now quite aware of the impacts of climate change and are stepping forward. And I'm sorry to say, but the Australian government has a bad reputation when it comes to the United Nations Convention on Climate Change. And while climate change, to me, while climate change is threatening the people of Kiribati and the rest of the world, the Australian government is seeing climate change as a cost on the Australian economy and a burden to the Australian government. And here we are talking about the survival, the life of people.
And Pacific leaders like Fijian Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, you know, they've said that, you know, you shouldn't turn up to COP26 unless you're willing to really be ambitious and commit to, you know, really strong emissions targets. What do you think the response is going to be at COP26 this year when Australia heads to Glasgow if they're just coming with the 2050 net zero commitment?
Look, I totally agree with the Prime Minister from Fiji. I think to me there's no point to go there with no ambition at all. And with my experience, I have attended like 5 COPs and advocated on behalf of my people at different levels of conferences and workshops. And Pacific Islanders are the ones, you know, we all know that they are the ones at the front line of the impacts of climate change. And yet, they are the ones who least contribute to this issue. At every COP, they work and fight so hard to be heard. And sadly, the world leaders from the most powerful developed countries, such as Australia, have the most influence and often hold the spotlight with their voices dominating the voices of the less developed countries like mine, Kiribati. And I must say that every COP that I have attended or watched from a distance, the outcome was always much lower than our hopes, with a failure to make real commitments. And we all know that the COP21 in Paris agreement was more uplifting for us because the 195 countries around the world finally signed a treaty to limit greenhouse gas emission. But yeah, the treaty came about as to me as a result of the tireless work of the Pacific Island nations.
And what does this decision by Australia to only commit to 2050 net emissions mean to you personally? Can you tell me a little bit about what exactly is happening in Kiribati in terms of climate change and what is forecasted to happen?
Look, Kiribati is one of the most vulnerable islands in the world, and so Tuvalu. A lot of people have to move from their homes because of erosion, because of storm surges. And some of us who don't know about Kiribati, Kiribati is just about two meters above sea level. And it's very vulnerable to climate change and the rising sea level. And this is other people, you know, this is that the people are impacted by climate change. And as I mentioned earlier on, that they hardly contribute to this climate change. And yet, you know, they are the first ones to be affected. And I must say, as a Pacific Islander with an Australian citizenship, I must say that it's very, very sad to see how the Prime Minister of Australia and the Australian government is responding to climate change. I must say, I just cannot understand why a human being like Mr. Morrison, would act in this way. And I am urging the Prime Minister on behalf of my people, if he's not doing it for the world, please do it for your children and the future and their future. Because climate change is right in front of our eyes. While the Pacific Islands are struggling with more intensive and frequent storm surges, heavy rainfalls and floods, the rest of the world is also experiencing the intensity of the impacts of climate change in multiple ways. People of Australia, of course, are also experiencing the impacts of climate change. And we saw that in the bushfires last year that sadly took lives and destroyed many homes. The whole world is stepping up, and I cannot understand why our Prime Minister is so obstinate and revolting. I'm sorry to use these words, but this is how I feel. And I'm very concerned for the lives of my families back in Kiribati and people around the world who are right at the front line of climate change. And our Pacific Islanders, our Pacific leaders have been fighting on this issue for many, many years. And I'm urging Scott Morrison to step up and put humanity first before the economy and stop blaming other countries.
And climate action has always been sort of a point of tension between Australia and its Pacific neighbours. What message is this exactly sending to people like yourself and across the region?
Look, the message is Australia to step forward and do what you know is right for not for the people in the Pacific, but for the young generation in Australia and for the whole world. And we need climate action right now. I mean, 2050, come on, 2050 is too far. You might have time. Australia might have time, as I said, but we are running out of time.
Well, Maria Seaman Chifang, thank you so very much for joining me here on Pacific Beat and discussing with me your feelings, your reactions, and echoing, I guess, what many people in the Pacific are probably feeling at the moment as well. Thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat.
Koraba, thank you.
Maria Seaman Chifang, a Kiribati woman there from the Edmund Rice Centre's Pacific Calling Partnership Program, speaking to me there. Now, with the Australian government finally releasing its climate change policy, committing to those net zero emissions by 2050, it has, of course, taken years of internal fighting within the Australian government. And it's also meant that it's faced tough criticism from Pacific neighbours. And you heard some tough criticism there from my guest just before. But it does have many more fights on its hands as well, including one by leaders from two remote islands in the Torres Strait. They're taking the Australian government to court in a bid to prevent the loss of their communities due to climate change. The two men are from Boigu and Saibai Islands, which are actually quite close to the PNG mainland than Australia, and they argue that their ancestral lands are under serious threat from rising sea waters. Indigenous Affairs editor Bridget Brennan reports.
Global warming is lapping at the doorstep of Australia's northernmost islands of Saibai and Boigu. As sea levels rise, Torres Strait Islanders Paul Kabai and Pabai Pabai fear for their communities and what it means for their connection to this land.
Maybe one day we'll be underwater. Our worry is we don't want to lose our island, our culture, our identity.
These men are leading a landmark class action against the federal government. They'll argue the Commonwealth has a legal responsibility to prevent the climate crisis.
It's helping my people, my community, in any other ways that we can do to enforce that.
It's a complicated case, it's a big case, but it's worth a shot because its impact is undeniable.
If global temperature rise soars beyond 1.5 degrees, scientists say the Torres Strait Islands will be in grave danger.
If we don't get our emissions down rapidly by mid-century, then it's a pretty horrific future for Torres Strait Islanders with increasing rate of sea level rise.
The case has been filed here at the federal court and it's the first of its kind in Australia. It's modelled on successful litigation in the Netherlands, which found the Dutch government had a human rights obligation to cut emissions even further.
What we're saying is that the Commonwealth owes a duty of care to Pabai and Paul and all of Torres Strait Islanders to take reasonable steps to protect them.
The Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction and the Minister for Indigenous Australians weren't available for comment. While global leaders prepare to meet in Scotland to commit to climate action, Torres Strait Islanders say their plight needs urgent attention.
We're not going to survive. If the government is not going to help us.
A fight for the survival of future generations. Bridget Brennan, ABC News.
Taking you now over to Papua New Guinea, where 14 Australian defence personnel have arrived today in the country to help the local defence force's COVID-19 response, including with rolling out vaccines. PNG is continuing to struggle with those rising cases and deaths from the highly contagious Delta strain, and local media reports the mortuary at PNG's biggest hospital is now full with more than 300 bodies, and plans are underway for a mass burial. A UK medical team arrived at the weekend to help treat patients, and the local health department is trying to recruit retired health workers as well as graduate nurses and other health workers to help with the growing caseload and vaccine rollout. From Port Moresby, here's our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting.
This is the first time COVID-19 vaccinations have come to Gare Village.
It has been brought to our doorstep. It was a chance for us, for me to come and take it.
The community is about an hour's drive from PNG's capital, Port Moresby. Most people make the trip on a public bus known as a PMV.
It's very hard for some of us to go to town because of the PMV fare. So like some of us can't afford it.
Vaccines have been in the country since March, but there's a new sense of urgency and a new push to take the vaccines to the people.
I officially launched central provincial vaccination rollout to the public.
PNG has officially recorded around 27,600 cases and 335 deaths. But that's likely a vast underestimation because only 205,000 tests have been conducted since the pandemic began. As a Delta wave of COVID-19 infections crashes over PNG, less than 2% of the country's total population is fully vaccinated.
When it started, unfortunately, this variant is different and it passes on much more easily and it's a bit more fatal. So that's why the urgency. I suppose our problem is we didn't recognize the problem quickly and try to attack it earlier on.
This clinic is being run with the local church, but elsewhere religion has been used to dissuade people from getting vaccinated. In the vastly Christian country, faith holds huge sway.
I'm a little bit worried on preachers preaching in the street, discouraging people not to be vaccinated.
People are believing because...
We don't believe it. We're not thinking about getting the vaccine. Malaria, typhoid and TB we know. We get treated for it and are worried about it. The other sicknesses we don't know, including COVID.
Even among those who believe in COVID-19, there are still high rates of fear and hesitancy around the vaccine. Authorities have blamed that largely on misinformation and conspiracy theories being shared online. In some communities, medical workers going to offer the vaccine have even been attacked or threatened. Harrowing vision of the toll this surge of COVID-19 is taking has helped drive demand for the jab.
We will be making and continue making vaccines available right throughout our country. And I encourage all citizens to go down the path of vaccination.
Why haven't we seen this sooner? Why didn't we see more urgency sooner? And has that been a failure of your government?
At the central level, we've been advocating vaccines and pushing them out. In my view, vaccines has been a rollout, but the people respond to be vaccinated is slow in coming. And I believe in our people not being forced to do things against their will.
There haven't always been lines like this for the jab. This clinic in Port Moresby is administering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, a new offering in PNG. Elsewhere, AstraZeneca and China's Sinopharm vaccine are also available. Australia has been supplying doses of its domestically made AstraZeneca, but production is set to stop next year.
We anticipate delivering over 60 million doses of vaccines into the Indo-Pacific, and that would include as many doses as are needed.
Widespread outbreaks in PNG pose a threat not only to the people here, but elsewhere, as it increases the risk of COVID-19 mutating again.
We do take our responsibilities as a neighbour and a friend to PNG very, very seriously. So whether it's cash support, whether it's vaccines, whether it's specialist support, all of those things are on the table.
It's good that, you know, we have to help one another. So I think people should get the vaccine for the welfare of the people of Papua New Guinea.
That report there from our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
Hold the front page!
Let's find out now all the news-making headlines around the region this morning. And I am, of course, joined by reporter Liam Fox. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Jordan.
Liam, on the subject of climate change and COP26, of course, we've been chatting about that here on the show after Australia announced its net zero emissions target by 2050. And we've heard a pretty lukewarm response from Pacific Islanders about it. But Vanuatu says that it's not going to be able to send delegates to Glasgow for the COP26 meeting.
Yes, it's a big issue who is able to go and who won't be going. Of course, the COVID pandemic makes travel to Europe from the Pacific a pretty difficult thing, particularly with quarantine requirements both on the way there and on the way back. And the full picture of who's going and who's not going is still emerging. But Vanuatu has said it will not be sending delegates to Glasgow for COP26. And this is a pretty big thing, as it will be for any Pacific Island nation who is unable to attend, but particularly for Vanuatu. I mean, it's consistently ranked amongst the most vulnerable countries to the impacts of climate change. Other Pacific Islands aren't far behind them. According to the Daily Post, the acting manager of the National Advisory Board on Climate Change and Disaster Risk Reduction, Florence Iautu, has said that they will not be sending any delegates. Instead, they will be physically represented by Vanuatu's ambassador in Geneva and a representative from the embassy in Brussels. She said that preparations are underway for Vanuatu to join discussions virtually. But as we've heard before on the show, that is difficult. A lot of the negotiations at previous COPs have been done, you know, outside official meetings, in hallways, on the sidelines, and a lot of important stuff gets done in those areas. So joining virtually will have its limitations. As we mentioned, the full story of who is going and who is not from the Pacific is still emerging. A number of people and NGOs are on their way now. Some are sending delegates and lots of delegates. We've just seen Fiji announce it's sending some 30 or so delegates to COP, including the Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama. And that's a lot more than some other bigger countries around the world, a lot bigger delegation than some other countries are sending. But at least Fiji is going to be represented in numbers.
Mm. Yeah. It's always, of course, very difficult, the fact that I believe perhaps a third of Pacific Island countries are not going to be able to send delegates just because of those COVID-19 restrictions hampering their ability to do that. Obviously, that puts a dent in their ability with their united voice to come to the table and talk about their concerns about climate change. But like you say, still emerging. We're still going to find out who exactly will be able to make it come when it starts Sunday, I believe, in just a couple of days. Now, Liam, let's turn over to Solomon Islands. Yesterday, we reported on an explosion that killed two people in Honiara. Initial reports suggested that it was caused by a World War II bomb, but now police say that that's not actually the case.
Yes, that's right. The victims in this explosion were from a family in Betekama in Honiara's east. They were cooking their evening meal when the explosion happened. The father and a young son were killed. A mother and another son are in hospital in a critical condition. As you said, initial reports suggested it was caused by a World War II bomb buried under their cooking fire. As we know, unexploded World War II ordnance is a massive problem in Solomons and around Honiara in particular. Police say that is not the case. Their investigators have been to the scene. Rather, they believe it was a piece of galvanized pipe that was near the fire that caused the explosion. It heated up due to the fire and then exploded. In a statement, police said there was no hole or crater at the scene, suggesting it was not a bomb, but rather that metal pipe, which was said to have contained, quote, energized and highly flammable materials.
And now heading over to Tonga, health authorities are urging parents there to, I understand, get their children vaccinated against COVID-19 before vaccines expire there.
Yeah, we've spoken this week about how the vaccine rollout for kids aged between 12 and 17 getting underway in a big way in Tonga and Samoa. But in Tonga, the health ministry is racing to get nearly 14,000 kids inoculated before their Pfizer doses expire in 28 days' time. According to Matangi Tonga, the health CEO says parents need to get their kids vaxxed by the third week of November or they'll miss out. So far, they've inoculated or given the first jab to around 1,000 kids. So another 13,000 need to get done in the next month or so. So far in Tonga, 51% of the population, that's around 53,000 people, have had their first dose of a vaccine. 35% are fully vaccinated. The government has indicated it wants at least 70% of people to be fully vaccinated before it considers reopening its international borders. So some way to go there before that can happen.
Well, Liam Fox, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
Thank you.
Time now to get a weather update from the region, starting in PNG's capital, Port Moresby. It's going to be a lovely sunny day there today. Lots of fine weather expected across the entire day and looking to a high of 33 degrees. It's also going to be sunny this morning in Suva as well. That will turn into a bit of an overcast afternoon and the top of 28 there today. 29 degrees in Port Vila, and it's going to be a rainy start to the morning again, but that will be easing off in the early afternoon into some finer weather. In Honiara, it will be fine this morning as well, but a chance of showers and possibly thunderstorms developing in the afternoon and a high of 31 degrees there. Then over to Samoa up here, a top of 30 degrees, and it's going to be cloudy with some brief showers expected in the afternoon. And a sunny day in Nuku'alofa, you can expect mainly fine weather and a top of 26 degrees. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And the story that I've got for you now, it's pretty amazing. It's an interview with the first Samoan to be appointed head coach of a first grade rugby league club anywhere in the world. He says he hopes his success will encourage other top flight Samoan players to look at making the switch to coaching when they retire from the game. Willie Poaching has taken the reins at Wakefield Trinity in the English Super League. And he says he's acutely aware that he is a pioneer and hopeful that he's broken down the wall so that other Samoans can follow his lead in the future. A former captain and coach of Toa Samoa, he has told Pacific Beat that he would like to have another crack at leading his national team at some point in the future. But prior to securing his top job at Wakefield, he had supporting roles at three other English clubs. And speaking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Yorkshire in Northern England, Willie Poaching said, "It's certainly been a long road to the top."
It has, and I'd be lying if I didn't say I questioned at times if it would happen, but I knew with perseverance and the will, I suppose, of wanting to get there and stick with it and using the opportunities as an assistant coach to keep honing my craft as a coach was going to give me the opportunity to stick at it and hopefully get in the seat one day, which has happened. So, yeah, it took 15 years and I asked my wife when I started coaching to give me 10 without really understanding what it took to be a head coach, that there's competition for, I think it's 28 spots in the world. So it makes you really, really appreciate the opportunity that I've been given.
Clearly, it matters to you that as a Samoan, you have sealed this number one job with Wakefield in England. It clearly matters to the Samoan people and the Samoan rugby league followers, going on what the reaction we've seen in social media in this part of the world. And it matters in Australia too. I'm wondering, does it matter in England? Has the fact that you are of Samoan heritage made headlines over there?
Not really. The story came out. That was written for Forbes, and that was the first time really a few of my mates and family had pointed it out to me and we'd spoken about it, but publicly that was the first article or first time that I'd spoken to someone about it, and then speaking to yourself now. And it probably has a little bit more significance at home, but no one here has spoken about it, and I don't think anyone's too aware of it. But yeah, I don't do the social media thing, so that's really nice that it's got some attention. And the reason I went into coaching was to pass on the knowledge that I'd been imparted with in all my years of playing and all the years that I was involved before I stepped into it. I'd always wanted to do that. I felt that as a bit of my duty of being in the game, because my dad taught me and I had some wonderful coaches for me to pass some of that knowledge on and help the next generation of players. And I'm sure there's somebody else of Samoan, of Pacific Island descent, that wants to do that as well. And if they want to, hopefully my sitting in this position now gives them the thought that, hey, this can be done.
What about the national side? You've coached and captained Toa Samoa in your time. Would you like to do that again, bearing in mind the logistical obstacles involved?
You know, the world's so small now. It's easier to communicate and you can do all these Zoom videos. And it's not the ideal way to coach, but, you know, contact can be made and held a lot easier now. But yeah, somewhere down the track, I'd love to get involved again. It means so much to me and my family, because my dad was one of the people that was involved in the establishment of Samoa Rugby League and Pacific Rugby League, and we were youngsters watching him get it all up and running. So it's always meant a lot to us, Samoa Rugby League, and a lot to me. And I'd like to be involved in it again one day. I probably rushed into it coaching-wise when I sat as the head coach for Samoa. And I'd like to think I'm a much better coach, a much more mature coach now. But for the time being, my focus is with Wakefield. But yeah, I'd love to be back involved with the national team at some stage.
Would you take some inspiration from Christian Wolfe, one of your rivals over there, looking after St Helens and very successfully, and of course, taking Tonga to within an ace of the last World Cup final?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. We look at the number of players that we've got playing now, and you look at the Penrith side alone and some of the players that they have and the wealth of Samoan talent that they have in their squad. If we're able to put a team with that calibre together that could rival what Tonga have done, yeah, for sure, the opportunities in Samoa could really shock the world.
Do you see Samoa as being legitimate challengers when the World Cup gets played, we hope, next year?
Definitely. If they can put the squad together that they could possibly get together, you know, and they're 12 months down the track, and hopefully for Samoa, Jerome Luai and Josh Papali'i and Young Crichton and Brian To'o, they're willing to put their hand up for Samoa, but also they're in the form that they finished the season in and winning the premiership. There's loads that Samoa can pick from now. And if those players are in form and playing well and they pledge their allegiance to Samoa, then there's no reason why Samoa couldn't be a force.
And coming back to our starting point and your appointment at Wakefield Trinity, what are your ambitions for the club now? And I mean, could we expect to see maybe one or two more Pacific Islanders crossing over to England to join you there?
If they're good enough, if they're going to fit into the model we're trying to create, there's going to be no charity, no tokenism. Looking to put the best squad together, and if a Pacific Island player fits what we're trying to look for, then we'll have a chat and we'll chase after him if that's the case. But as far as the club is concerned, we're just trying to be as successful as we can on the field and create a model of success off the field as well, as far as the culture and helping young men become better rugby league players, but to grow as young men. We just spoke as a club that we want good people around, and we want the club to be as ambitious and as successful as we can on all fronts.
Willie Poaching, a pioneering Samoan, now that he's taken over as coach of Wakefield Trinity Rugby League Club in England. And he was speaking there to Richard Hewitt.
The Friday Forum. Two guests, three rules. Rule one, tell us a story that made you angry.
The crisis of governance in PNG's power sector made me feel very disappointed for the many people in Papua New Guinea who have no electricity.
Rule two, what story this week made you feel good?
The Melbourne Rebel teams were able to, first of all, fly out of Victoria, which is grand, and had our first match against the Brumbies.
And rule three, let's lighten up on a Friday. What story made you laugh?
This story couldn't help but make me laugh. Parliament here brought in a special sort of new dress code, and they call it Kia Orana Fridays. Women wearing Rito hats, the men wearing island shirts. There's lots of fresh flower A's.
I would love to come and just smell Parliament, because you've made it sound like it smells divine in their fresh florals.
The Friday Forum on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Workers from Pacific Islands have managed to help save Australia's blueberry crops this year for farmers on Australia's central east coast. Last year, many crops went to waste because they didn't have any of their traditional workers, like backpackers, because of those COVID-19 border restrictions. That changed this year, though, when the local berry cooperative Oz Group Co-op, which represents more than 150 berry farmers, brought in more than 200 workers from Vanuatu and Solomon Islands. Now, Keely Johnson has the story, and she began by speaking with Oz Group's acting CEO, Stephen Thandy, who says the workers have been a lifesaver.
This is the first year of picking. The first couple of picks are slow, but now they're really up to speed as with the regular contractors.
So it hasn't taken long?
No, it hasn't taken long. No, they're really good. They've got good work ethics.
Now, tell me, what happened last year when COVID was about but there wasn't this scheme in place?
Towards the end of the year, we lost literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of fruit. A lot of the contractors that were in Australia, they left to go back into the grape seasons in other parts of Australia, and we were left hanging here.
And it's not just you. You've been speaking to other, your neighbours, other farmers. Did they also lose a lot of crop last year?
They certainly did. And we did put it out to all of our group growers to be part of this scheme. At first, they all jumped on it. Then they got hesitant. It was left to us, 18 or 19 at the end, that stayed on the scheme. We did actually have, supposed to have 300 people come in, but only 211 available.
Do you know why that was?
It's a quarantine cost. It's the flights weren't coming in, so we've been told. Then they're going to source them from within Australia. Now they've been used up elsewhere, so we're down 90-odd people.
And how helpful has the Pacific Island workers been?
Oh, they've been great. You know, they got great work ethics. They want to work. Minimal amount of headache. You tell them to do a job once, they'll do it.
Stephen says the industry has relied on these workers from overseas, as Australians just aren't jumping at farm labour work.
You won't get an Australian worker doing some hard yakka. That's gone in the past. Oz Group itself is part of the BCCM, which is the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals, and I've had contact with other chairs from around Australia, and they're all in the same situation. So there's no one that wants to work from within Australia in the farming sector.
Daniel Jim James used to work as a delivery driver in Vanuatu, but when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, he and many others lost work. He says when a Facebook post popped up on his feed advertising the opportunity to work on a farm in Australia, he applied right away.
We arrived about 2 months. We don't probably have much work, but after 2 months, we start busy. Yeah.
And why have you come to work in Australia?
The only opportunity that helped me a lot with my family. I grew up without that, so I used to help my mom and my other three brothers. So coming here is very good, helped me a lot. So now I have family, they depend on me, yeah.
Do you send money back home to Vanuatu?
I already sent 4 times, yeah. Most of us lost job. Because we have a small economic, many people lost job, so opportunity to come here is very good to everyone.
Similar to Daniel, Natalie Harrow has come to work in Australia to support her family back in the Solomon Islands, most of which have also lost work.
My sister got laid off from work. Yeah, it's kind of hard to get a job back in my country.
And how have you found coming to Australia? Has it been all right?
Yeah. Gives me the privilege to help my family back at home with the money I earn here. I send them some money and I get by fine with my earnings here. We don't get this kind of money we earn here. We don't get that back at home in a week.
That was Natalie Hiro, who is currently working on a blueberry farm on the Coffs Coast in Australia's east, and she's supporting her family back in the Solomon Islands. That story there from Keely Johnson. And for more on their stories, you can head to our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page where we've shared that story. And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat here on this Wednesday morning. Thank you so very much for your company. I will be back tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. But right now, you're headed to 5 minutes of the news.